I'm Dr. Casey Mixon, Assistant Professor at Valdosta State University's Psychology, Counseling, and Family Therapy Department and Project Director for the Military Families Learning Network Family Development Team. Along with Barry Sobelson, Licensed Family Therapist and MFLN Family Development Programming Coordinator, we invite you to join us for our anchored podcast conversations. We started this podcast in hopes to support and inspire those connected to military families. Each episode focuses on real-life struggles and practical solutions to lessen the harmful ripple effects. We invite you to sit back, relax, and get anchored with us. Today, we're going to be talking to Dr. Shelley Green and Dr. Douglas Flemons. Shelley and Douglas are co-directors of Context Consultants, a private therapy practice in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. In addition to their practice, they are both professors at Nova Southeastern University in the Family Therapy Program. Shelley and Douglas are co-editors of Quickies, the Handbook of Brief Sex Therapy. Shelley is the author of numerous articles in the areas of sexuality, HIV, AIDS, and clinical training and supervision. Douglas is the author of books on hypnosis, relational suicide assessment, in addition to many, many other academic writings. So let's get started. Well, hello there. We're excited about today's anchored podcast, as we're coming to you on a beautiful sunny day from the campus of Valdosta State University. Our guest today traveled from the warm and lovely South Florida, the Fort Lauderdale area, where they live and they work and play, hopefully too,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
We have Dr. Douglas Flemons and Dr. Shelley Green here with us today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I know about you and your important work, but I'd love for our audience to get to know you more. So if you'll introduce yourself and tell us what you'd like us to know about you, that'd be great.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'm Shelley Green, and I'm sitting here with Douglas Flemons, who is my co-therapist, partner in crime, husband, father of my children. We do a lot of things together. We teach together, we present together, we do therapy together.
In less than a month, we're going to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary.
Yeah, congratulations.
And we actually met in graduate school, so that's the danger about graduate school, that you meet people that have a lot in common with you and end up sharing your lives together.
How is that a danger?
Because it can change your life in significant ways.
Lives,
so people should be aware, if they're considering graduate school, that it will change your life.
So we do a lot of stuff together, obviously, like Shelley's telling you, but we work together, but we also have individual interests. You are a horsewoman of the universe.
I'm very passionate about horses.
I like horses, but I don't have the virus.
It's definitely a gene. I don't know if it's a gene flaw.
I thought it was a virus.
No, it's a gene. Either you have it or you don't, and I definitely have it.
You can't get rid of it.
You can't get rid of it, so Douglas has
had
it.
No, I can't get rid of it.
You see, there was a danger. I told you. Yeah, I'm very passionate about horses, and for the last almost 10 years, I've been combining my passion for horses with my passion for therapy, and I've developed an equine therapy program at NSU in partnership with the nonprofit that I helped to found called Stable Place. So we conduct equine therapy, we do trainings, we do clinical work, we do CEU workshops, we do supervision and training in the community, and we have a grant to work with foster care kids right now. We're working with a wide range of populations. So it allows me to be with horses, which is a huge passion of mine, and it allows me to continue to do therapy in a really outside-the-box experiential way, outside the therapy room, out in nature, which I love. So if I'm at the barn, I'm usually happy.
And you're inventing a really unique way of working. It's just incredible.
I hope so. Yeah. It feels like it's something new. It really feels very, very energizing. And a lot of what we'll talk about today in terms of brief therapy is what I'm bringing to the equine therapy world. We're really, everyone who works with us on our team is trained in the family therapy classes at Nova and in the equine therapy classes that I teach there. So all of our therapists who do equine work are coming from a brief therapy, very systemic, very relational perspective. And I think that is unique in the equine therapy world. So it's been really exciting.
Yeah.
Really fun. And you are a hypnotherapist and Ericksonian and Batesonian thinker, theorist.
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff in hypnosis. So when you're at the barn, I'm typically seeing a
writing.
Big part of my practice is doing hypnosis. And then I was a director of a student counseling center for 6.5 years. And coming out of that, I became very interested and very involved in doing suicide assessments. And so I've been promoting that important work for a long time, do a lot of workshops on helping therapists learn how to do assessments that are not alienating for their clients and can actually be therapeutically helpful in the process of figuring out what would allow this person to be safest.
And you co-authored a book about that,
yes,
as well?
Yes, with a psychiatrist that worked with me at the Student Counseling Center on suicide assessment. Yep.
And then we're parents of two kids, 23-year-old Eric.
Two adults.
California. Yeah. Not two kids adults. Anymore. Two adults, which I guess I haven't really quite accepted yet. But our son is in California, and our daughter is almost 19. Jenna is a freshman at FSU. Mm-hmm. So I would say that this has definitely been the most exciting adventure of our lives. Mm. And to watch them turn into beautiful people that are our best friends has been really amazing.
It's given us a lot of insight into identity. Identity of us as parents, and how that shaped how we think as therapists. When we were both in graduate school as family therapists, we believed, and I think it's accurate, that we could be good family therapists without being parents, even though some of our clients didn't believe that. But I think having had kids, it's not just the experience of knowing how crazy it is to be a parent, but giving us a tremendous humility and to understand how identity gets created when you're responsible for another person and then how that changes when they leave. So it's been excellent learning.
Yeah, I definitely think it's made us better therapists and better people, really, in so many ways. Mm-hmm. Much more humble, for sure. You have to be.
And what a gift that your children have that you're willing to learn from them and be shaped or accepting of that shaping and that wonderful dynamic that can happen. Lovely.
Yeah.
Well, we invited you here today, to talk a little bit about the book that you co-edited. It's called Quickies, The Handbook of Brief Sex Therapy. And you have a revised edition that's coming out probably the first...
Within a year.
Yeah.
It should be out within a year. Yeah, we're getting it to our publisher in the next couple of months, so it should be out within a year.
And we were struck as the MFLN Family Development Team first of all, Barry and I, who is with me today, read this while we were in grad school.
Students.
So this was our introduction to any kind of therapy work that focuses on couples and specifically intimacy and sexuality. And so we wanted to kind of bring that up, with the Military Families Learning Network. A lot of times there's training and there's professional development opportunities that talk about, infidelity or communication problems or with military couples. However, not a lot of talk happens or discussions or professional development really kind of focuses on sex therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to talk specifically about the chapter that you co-write together in the Quickies book, which, by the way, who came up with that name?
I did. I approached my editor at Norton. I'd done a couple, three books with them and said, so my wife and I have an idea for a new book.
Uh-huh.
She said, yeah, tell me more. Well, it's an edited volume on brief approaches to sex therapy. And she said, we don't like edited volumes. They don't sell well. And so, no, I don't think so. And I said, I haven't told you the title yet. She said, what's the title? Quickies. Okay, let's talk. So it was the actual title that sold the book.
That sold the book. Changed her whole perspective, didn't it?
Yeah.
What prompted you, the conversations that got this book to even exist?
Well, I started teaching human sexuality when I was in my doctoral program at Texas Tech University, and I had been seeing clients in our clinic, and I always got the clients that were referred for sexual issues, and I just thought it was really fascinating. And then I got the opportunity to teach the sexuality class, which after about a month, I felt like I was born to do this. Like, this is what I just loved. I loved having the conversations with the students. I just loved everything about it. And then, so in graduate school, my practice became more and more geared towards working with gay and lesbian clients and working with sexuality issues. And I just got really, really interested in it. So then after I finished my doctorate and got into teaching at the university level, that was really my passion, was to teach the graduate course in human sexuality. So when I came to NSU the first year, I invited Douglas to teach the class with me. So we co-taught human sexuality, which was super fun to be able to teach it together as mm-hmm. a couple. And we were teaching it from the clinical perspective, not just human sexuality, but how to be a systemic relational sex therapist. Mm-hmm. And our frustration was that we would go in talking about all these brief therapy ideas and all these systemic relational models, and all the readings were from a traditional sex therapy perspective. So very linear, very dysfunction oriented, very diagnostic oriented.
So we had textbooks we would assign, and we'd say, well, this is what we disagree with here.
So it's more disagreement.
We would just deconstruct them every class. Yeah. And we were frustrated. The students were frustrated. And this went on for several years until we finally said, well, no one else is writing this book. Maybe we should do this.
The other thought was our students had the assumption that they were brief therapists, learning how to be brief for family therapists, both. And that when they encountered a sexual issue with their clients, that they would outsource it to a sex therapist.
Right.
And that just seemed to us wrong-headed. So we wanted them to come out of our class thinking, I have everything I need, given my therapeutic orientation, to be able to handle also sex therapy cases.
Mm-hmm. And I don't even have to change hats. Yes. I just do what I'm doing, but we're talking about sex.
And we fold it into the conversation. The patterns that exist.
We can use the same way, the same therapeutic orientation to inform how we would address those problems. You need something more than just being a brief therapist mm-hmm. in order to do it.
Sure.
So what else do you need? Mm-hmm. So then we thought, let's talk to the best brief therapists in the country about their sex cases and bring them together, and then we'd have a textbook. And so that's how it got created.
What are your thoughts on either therapists in training or just therapists that you know that do kind of refer out for sex therapy? What's your understanding of the need to distance themselves from talking about sex?
That is a great question. And I think it's our culture's very bizarre, polarized relationship with sex. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we have sex on our faces all the time, and you have 12-year-old girls posting, you know, porn pictures of themselves on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have this aversion to talking about sex, or the stigma around talking about sex, and anxiety talking about sex. So the open, transparent conversations about sex aren't so available. But all the strange sexual messages and hypersexualized culture is very available.
And what is sexy? And
right.
What does that mean from a societal perspective versus for the individual?
And it's very stigmatized, mm-hmm. and yet it's very, I guess, in your face is the way I think about it.
And so then there is a concern that we notice with our students. If I were to bring this up, how can I have a conversation about sex that isn't itself sexual?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And mm-hmm. and can I engage in that without myself worrying about becoming aroused or being embarrassed or whatever, and getting people
or being attracted to my client, or having my client be attracted to me, or
so. And how do you talk about things like that with your students, though? How is
very directly?
Yeah,
I love. I'll be teaching the class again in January, and I love it because we have 15 weeks to go into all of these very in-depth issues of how you talk about client sexual issues, how you deal with your own sexuality and your own potential attraction, and how you create boundaries. And we talk about it in terms of being warm but not hot. So you need a warm, intimate connection with your clients, but not intimate that crosses the line. You need to be able to speak directly and frankly and use language that's comfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And that might be street language, and that might be, you know, church language. But you have mm-hmm. to be comfortable kind of transcending all of that. So we spend a lot of time talking about how can you bring it up if they're not bringing it up. So I never end a first session with a couple without bringing up sex.
It's an analogous challenge as new doctors have in terms of how do you do a physical exam, and you're mm-hmm. seeing and touching a naked body in a non-sexual way. Mm-hmm. So our students, and then when they become therapists, have to have a conversation about nakedness or arousal or the lack of or whatever, and to be able to do that comfortably. Mm-hmm. The doctors have a way of dealing with it if they're not comfortable interpersonally, and that is they become cold. Mm-hmm. They can just put on their white coat and be removed, and we don't have the option. We have to be warm, and not hot, but warm. But it's a skill that can be learned. How do you bring up a topic and be able to feel comfortable doing it? And then ask very intimate questions.
And I would assume that you being comfortable in the room mm-hmm. then makes the client obviously much more comfortable, because if you're squirming or yes. if you're struggling to find language, then they're going to really struggle too. And that's a topic that a lot of people don't want to come talk to you about anyway.
But it's such a rich resource uh-huh. if you can talk to people about their sexuality and mm-hmm. their sexual connection with each other or lack of. Sometimes you find amazing resources that you might not otherwise know are there. They might be fighting all the time and yet they're having this great sexual connection. Or they yeah. might be getting along pretty well and be really struggling around sex. Mm-hmm. So you might have assumptions that could be completely inaccurate if you don't bring it up. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, you know, that's one of the main points that you bring up in chapter 8 in Quickies. It's titled Just Between Us, A Relational Approach to Sex Therapy. And you talk about the importance of freedom within 5 different relationships. And this, the relationship between the client and the couple, or you as the therapist mm-hmm. and your couples, is the first relationship that you talk about. The other 5 are the relationship between your clients, mm-hmm. Between your clients and sexuality, between you and sexuality, and which we kind of touched on too mm-hmm. about that when you're training or when you are working and talking with your students, really having to address or have them reflect on their own sexuality, yes. their own relationship to sex, and being able to have conversations about that with their clients. And then also to your clients and their problem. So can you speak to maybe some examples with clients that can illustrate any of those relationships? I know in the book you give great illustrations, but would you mind speaking to that?
Sure. And I think those 5 mm-hmm. relationships are also interconnected. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so much of it centers around that relationship between you and your client.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say, before we talk about the examples, the reason that we suggest thinking in terms of the relationships is that is where change happens. Mm-hmm. So if you think about you have this problem, and let's go in and fix this problem as if it's an isolated entity, it can create difficulties for you as a therapist as far as intervention possibilities. But if you're thinking what you're doing is changing the person's relationship to that problem, and you're altering or at least facilitating the process of a relationship changing between the couple, it's much easier as a therapist in terms of how do you initiate something to be different. So that relational focus is central to it. And that's what informs our thinking for all these cases we're going to tell you.
Central to you, and then also distinguished from what, Shelley, you were talking about before, with traditional sex mm-hmm. therapy, yeah. where you're looking at dysfunction among within an individual.
Yes, exactly.
Or within the individuals.
And how reassuring for a client mm-hmm. to be able to go, oh my gosh, this isn't just a problem that is mine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that very often that's how clients come in. Mm-hmm. Not if it's either mine or what's wrong with him. Uh-huh, you know, uh-huh. what fix him? Mm-hmm. And we just don't think in that way. I mean, we can't even conceptualize. I think so many years of thinking systemically and relationally, we can't even conceptualize an individual problem. But so much of sex therapy literature is written
because you have to isolate the problem in order to diagnose it. Mm-hmm, and sure. we're wanting to make contextual sense of it. How does this problem fit? How does it make sense given everything that's going on? Of
How does
course,
it make perfect sense?
But don't you think that's a societal
there.
Issue too? That they carry the problem within themselves?
Absolutely.
I mean, look at all these commercials that we see for all these different pills that'll fix
Completely.
It or
yeah.
that'll that's make right. it better, because it's your problem. It's
yeah.
not anybody,
and you're
it's
a
not
sex
your
addict
couples.
Or,
yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's so much attention to sex addiction and and pathology related to some internal description of what's going on with someone sexually. And we just don't think in that way.
How do you orient your clients to the way you think, or to explain just that we're not looking at this as a problem within you?
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't do too much explanation because we can do that with our students because they're there signing up to learn. Mm-hmm. Our clients are interested in something being different, so we don't want to get into this didactic mm-hmm. place with them. Mm-hmm.
But we can do it through questions.
We can do it through questions and through where our curiosity is, and then through what they discover. They may never be able to describe what it was that we are doing. They just know that it doesn't become an issue anymore. That's the
point. And it feels better talking about it.
Yes.
Or feels more comfortable, less stigma. Less, more the vulnerability can be easier too.
And so I think there can be a lot of shame around mm-hmm. sex. Mm-hmm. And so people come in with a lot of shame, maybe with how it was talked about in their families or with experiences they've had that they don't feel good about themselves or they feel that they've been judged. And that is a lot of it. And so our curiosity is then about how that might be incorporated in their relationship and how can we tease that out and turn that a little bit so that it doesn't dominate or mm-hmm. doesn't speak for the relationship itself. So a lot of it just has to do with the kinds of questions we ask. And like Douglas said, the curiosity that we have that isn't about how long have you had this problem. That just wouldn't ever be a question that we would ask. Because we look at what happens between them. So mm-hmm. when he does this or when she does this, what does she do? So we're looking at their dynamics and their interactions, which mm-hmm. can be a less shame-inducing or a less deficit-producing conversation, I think.
I'm seeing a young man at the moment who is gay, and the only way that he can convince himself to go and have sex is to do crystal meth. Mm-hmm. And he feels really bad about that and comes in thinking, I've got to solve this problem of crystal meth. And in talking to him about what happens in his sexual relationships, they're always the same. He has a role that he assumes in the relationship. And he says that if he doesn't use crystal, it's too boring. He said he wasn't interested enough in it. And so the crystal becomes an aphrodisiac. What made sense to me was that the consistency and the predictability of the sexual relationships that he could have was a source of boredom. And rather that it be a problem with his sexuality, there's perhaps a predictability that becomes inevitably boring. And that one solution to that is crystal, because it then puts everything on steroids, as it were, and it pushes the boundaries of the script to the degree, well, it doesn't change it, it just makes it more interesting inherently. But another way to do that, and we've just started to explore that, is if he were to engage in the vulnerability of finding himself doing something different. And when I suggested that, he said, but why would I do that? That's not what turns me on. Mm-hmm. And I said, I wondered what might happen if he allowed himself to have a sexual interaction with somebody that he predicted wouldn't be helpful or wouldn't be hot. But he could allow himself to be vulnerable enough to discover something. And then he might then learn something about arousal in that process. So it rather than staying in the same rut and trying to just make it tolerable through crystal, it could be getting out of the rut and finding how crazily scary it is. But there's something that goes along with anxiety and desire. That if you're in a new realm testing limits, that can also be very arousing. So we'll see what happens. That's the direction that we're headed at the moment.
But you set it up as an experiment, not as a, you need to not do crystal meth.
Yeah, like a don't
exactly.
do.
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a young man a couple of years ago who came in because he was anxious, because he was having dreams about same-sex encounters that he found really arousing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was from another country, and he was very clear that his family would never accept if he was gay. So he was very, very disturbed about these dreams. And then as he would feel shame about the dreams, then he would also find himself at night out on the streets looking in gay bars and kind of experimenting with that, and then going home and feeling terrible shame and guilt about that. So he was coming to me, and I think maybe a more traditional approach would have been, let's figure out if you're really gay, and maybe you're really gay. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to thinking about that idea of the client, the relationship between the client and their problem, mm-hmm. my goal wasn't to figure out if he's gay. Mm-hmm. So we kind of stay out of the realm of what's the truth that's happening here, and let's find out what the mm-hmm. truth is, and more in the realm of what is the process? What is it that you're going through, and how are you relating to? And his mm-hmm. the way he was relating to it was, make it stay away. I don't want to be gay. Just, mm-hmm. you know, please tell me that I'm not gay. So we ended up talking about the guilt and shame more mm-hmm. than anything, and the anxiety around it. And I invited him to give himself some time to imagine gay experiences, mm-hmm. gay sex, minus guilt or shame, and just to protect some time to do that. And that would just be his special time when he could consider that, absent shame and guilt, and then just to track what was happening with the dreams and then what was happening with and we did a lot of other talk, of course, about his family and how he knew what their response might be, and where there were gaps in his knowledge or awareness of clarity about that. And he came back a couple of weeks later and said, you know, I don't really know if I'm gay, I don't really know if I'm straight, but I think I'm okay mm-hmm. either way. So it could become less urgency around deciding this is true or that's true. Mm-hmm. He could change his relationship to it.
So you made it safe, created a protection for him to engage in the imagination in a way that he couldn't. So part of what we're also doing then is thinking about the relationship between the person and their sexuality, and figuring out how does sexuality work. Mm-hmm. So if you have an idea and it's taboo in some way, and it's inducing shame because my parents would disown me if they thought that was the case, there's something about desire that gets infused with energy when you're crossing into some territory that's not allowed. So your experiment with him took away the potential for the shame to induce desire and make it much easier to then explore, so how much am I actually engaged or intrigued by this?
Mm-hmm. Right, and maybe I am, and maybe that's okay. Because yeah. I think of his life being, there was no place in his life where someone wouldn't be invested in him not being gay. Mm-hmm. So I think also to come into a conversation where I was kind of like, if you are, if you're not, it, you know, it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter. That was new for him. So then to be able to take a deep breath and just think, okay, maybe I can just see where this goes mm-hmm. and figure this out. And I might not know next week or next year, but that might be okay. It takes some urgency away.
It took the grip of shame off yeah. and opened up so possibilities, mm-hmm. you know, could become apparent
right.
to him and really his future, mm-hmm. get him unstuck out of that. You know, this conversation about shame and, you know, I think you're absolutely right with there being a culture of secrecy around sexuality and sex, but then also in your face all the time.
Yes.
I know too when a couple weeks ago we had one of our webinar presenters was Dr. Rita Brock, and she talks a lot about moral injury, and you know, when military service professionals, you know, are put in this this juxtaposition, this position of, you know, killing or doing something horrific that goes against their moral fibers,
yes. yeah.
and the shame that comes about with this. And I can imagine, and I don't know that it's really talked about a lot, mm-hmm. but that piece of shame and coming back, we have a lot of service professionals or military people that I've worked with that say, I don't want for my spouse or my partner, if they knew
what I've done, they
wouldn't love me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm wondering, and, you know, how even talking about how that influences their sexual intimacy, their emotional connection. Mm-hmm. The physical connection has been a part, mm-hmm. but it reintegrating and coming back with your partner, I'm wondering how that influences the sexual connection.
Mm-hmm. It's a terrific question. There's got to be.
It was long-winded, Douglas.
but you touch on such an important component of all experience, which mm-hmm. is if part of you says another part of me is unacceptable, mm-hmm. like profoundly existentially unacceptable, mm-hmm. then it's exhausting because mm-hmm. you're never in a settled place. Mm-hmm. If you act on what feels like an urge or a desire, went back to sex, and then there's another part of you that condemns it, but you feel like this is the acting on it or the imagining of it feels authentic in some way, and then that's totally existentially unacceptable. There's never a subtle place where mm-hmm. you can accept yourself. And that can also then increase desire, too, because mm-hmm. there's this battle, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't, oh, I'm going to, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't, oh, I'm going to. So what therapists can do in a situation like that through accepting and making contextual sense of what's going on is provide a shift in the relationship between the person and their experience so that it can just be what it is.
Mm-hmm. And also I'm thinking about the vulnerability that's so much an inherent part of intimacy. So if you experience true intimacy with someone, it's an incredibly vulnerable place. Mm-hmm. And if you're holding this shame about something that you've done and thinking, if they knew that I did this, they would never love me, then where's the vulnerability? Where's the intimacy? Mm-hmm. You can't cross that. It's like a wasteland between you and reaching them. And so what would have to happen in order to, break those walls down? So then it would make sense that there would be tremendous barriers between mm-hmm. couples where one is returning from a deployment, holding on to this fear of their partner, knowing the horrific things they've mm-hmm. even seen and witnessed, because I think sometimes even having witnessed and been present with something that's horrific feels like something you couldn't share with a civilian. Mm-hmm. And so that could create tremendous barriers to sexual intimacy and to emotional intimacy.
Absolutely. What stands out to you as far as maybe other client examples that you think would be helpful for our audience to hear about, or is just one of your favorites to talk about?
Well, as we're talking, I'm thinking about, to go back a little bit to the relationship between the therapist and sexuality. Mm-hmm. It's one thing that we do so much of in the class, because my assumption is it's really difficult to be effective talking to clients about their sexuality if you don't have a comfort level with your own, or mm-hmm. if you have these kind of barriers about your own sexuality. So we talk with the students, at length all semester. They're encountering issues and people that I bring in and that we talk about that they may have discomfort around that mm-hmm. may really go against either their religious beliefs or their values or these sexual practices that they just can't embrace. So we spend a lot of time talking about, not that you have to change your values, but how can you embrace that this is a choice for someone else? Mm-hmm. And how can you understand others' behavior and context without judging it from your own kind of perspective? And so
judging in distancing yourself.
Yes, yeah. Making them other. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the central message in the class. And so I guess I have prided myself, which is always a danger, that mm-hmm. that I am beyond that mm-hmm. I don't judge. And I got my comeuppance with the client that we write about in Quickies when I worked with a man many years ago who had AIDS, full-blown AIDS. He was very sick, and he came to me in desperate loneliness and devastation, just having everything, all the losses in his life. His friends had died. His lovers had died. His family had rejected him. He had nothing left except anonymous, unprotected sex. And so he's telling me this in the first half hour of the session. And I'm just sitting there with a rock in my stomach, mm-hmm. judging. And I, looking back, that's what was happening. I was judging. And I was also thinking in fear, like, what do I do? Who do I warn? How do I make him stop? This is so dangerous. I need to make him stop. So I was immediately othering him. I was putting him at a distance. And I I knew my training. I was very well trained. I knew that I needed to be making sense of his behavior, but I couldn't. And so I tried to ask non-judgmental questions, but I know that he felt the distance from me. And so I think of him a lot as one of my absolute failures, that I didn't connect well with him. I didn't respect where he was coming from. And we didn't have a horrible session, but he didn't come back. Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise. And so I've really been affected by him. And it reminds me that as open-minded as we may all think we are, there's a place that we will judge. Something will push our buttons, mm-hmm, and distance us from the client.
Well, we have a responsibility. You're asking the question, is there somebody I need to warn? Mm-hmm. We have a responsibility if somebody is going to do harm to someone else, sure, to do that. And so, I don't know if judgment's the right word, but certainly not acceptance and being concerned about what are the implications of this for many, 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 many other people. It's scary to get into a non-judgmental place because it feels like then you're potentially condoning it. And mm-hmm, your, I think, wonderful ethic of protection kept you from being able to accept the behavior that he was doing. You didn't want to give the impression that I endorse.
I condone this.
That you condone it. So it creates a very, very tricky ethical position to be.
But I think we can not condone but make sense of, mm-hmm, in context. And I think I wish that's where I could have gotten with him.
And another kind of example, at least one that I've, you know, had to struggle through and that I've noticed a lot of my students have had to struggle through in their training, is when you're working with perpetrators of violence,
yes,
mm-hmm, on children especially, mm-hmm, or when there's domestic violence and there's a clear perpetrator, someone who has power and control and manipulates, and there's, it's more directional. And that's hard to get past. But
it's,
I
really
think
hard.
That really, I don't condone this, but let me make sense of this in context. Mm-hmm. And really, it's a struggle as a therapist to get to that place.
It really is. And a lot of our students will say, I could never work with a sex, mm-hmm, offender. And yet, in the sexuality class, we talk a lot about working, mm-hmm, with sex offenders. Mm-hmm. And sex offenders come to the class and tell their story. And it's a difficult day, mm-hmm, in class. But you're right. It's not about condoning. It's about widening your lens to understand how in this context this happened, mm-hmm, and given that it did happen and we're not condoning it, and yet the person is more than that act.
Exactly. That human, like, this person is,
that's
a human,
not everything,
with, yeah, a heart.
And yes, if they're more than that act, then there's options. So our goal is to get to the place where we can say, mm-hmm, empathically putting myself in your position, mm-hmm, of course you're doing that, mm-hmm, of course, given the way that your life has, the course it's taken, and that you have nothing left except your sexuality, and you are furious that somebody gave you this horrible disease, of course you are combining retribution with sexual pleasure, and that makes sense.
And that could have been empathic and connected.
That's
right?
One way to deal with the grief that you face, mm-hmm, looking at death and at the disappointment and so on. That's one way to do it. But if you're bigger than just that act, then what are other ways that you could satisfy these incredibly important needs that you have? And are you interested in exploring that?
And how does it make sense that you're so desperately lonely,
yeah,
that this is the one way that you reach out? I think some empathy would have made a big difference with this client.
When I was in my master's program trying to learn how to do this kind of stuff, I had a mother and her son that came to see me, and they were fighting like crazy all the time, fighting. And I had just gone to a Virginia Satir workshop where she had people get from being very alienated with one another to being very, very close, to bridge that gap. And she did it through having them make a physical connection and an eye-to-eye connection. So in the midst of this session that wasn't going well, his son was probably, I don't know, 14 or something, I told him that I'd just been to this workshop and I'd seen this done, and I think it would be marvelous for their relationship. Will you just turn toward each other, and I'd like you to take hands, and I want you to look in each other's eyes, and I want you to talk genuinely about what it is that really hurts you. and they didn't, for some reason, turn toward one another and take each other's hands, and became united together in what an idiot I was. The mother said, "Do you know how hard it was for me to get to this session? And you want to waste my time with this drivel?" And the son had his arms crossed and was glaring at me. And that was my last session with him. I was desperate, and I was thinking that there's a technique that I could do that would solve their problem. And that it's all I have to do is deliver the right technique, and this unfortunate two people that just can't figure out how to, what's wrong with you? You can't figure out how to get along. Let me deliver this technique and I'll solve it
for you. You didn't earn the right to exactly. be able to do that with
No, because they totally knew I didn't get either of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the other relationship, is getting inside of their experience to such a degree that they can trust that you appreciate where they're mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. And then they can start to listen. Then it can be safe to be vulnerable with you.
Sure.
But until then,
forget
very
it.
Wise. They were very smart to get the hell out of that office as fast as they could.
But if I could just tell a quick story that when you actually can get in their worldview, even when you're scared and even when you think you need to take some action. So I worked with a woman a few years ago who came in absolute crisis because she had discovered a couple days before that her husband had been having an affair with a good friend of hers, and she had found him in the act, and it was, you know, incredibly traumatic, and she, you know, she sobbed through the first hour. It was just a very, very difficult session, and she came in alone, and so a lot of it was just figuring out, is she emotionally stable enough even to leave here and all of this, and somewhere during the middle part of the session, she started to tell me all the fantasies she was having about what she wanted to do to the woman who had the affair with her husband. And she wanted to, you know, burn a fuck you on her yard and so in the grass so that she couldn't get rid of it, and spray paint stuff on her house. And then she also wanted to go to her house with razor blades and cut her face. And it was a pretty intense session. And she was pretty intent on that she wanted to do these things. So again, I'm thinking, what do I need to do? Do I need to get the woman's name? And what I decided to do was take a big deep breath and deal with my blood pressure rising and figure out a way to get into her world mm-hmm. and figure out a way to make sense of, in this moment, given what she had just found, that she would want to do this. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't she want to do this? And we spent an hour and a half just talking about that. And making sense of it. And she came to realize that I got it, that she would want to do this. Mm-hmm. And as she came to realize that I got it, we were able to back away from, but not from me telling her, you know, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. I started asking her all the things in her life that would help her decide not to do that. And it was her children and her, you know, her desire to actually save this marriage, which she really still wanted to save. And so she backed herself away from the willingness to do it, but I didn't try to back her away from the fantasy. So then we just talked about what she would do if the fantasy came up again and how she might even embrace the fantasy and not the action. And so when I've talked about this story with students, they all say, but why didn't, you know, you should have called the police. Or, you know, it's mm-hmm. there's a fear-based reaction.
Danger report.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I will say that it was a risk.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It turned out to be well worth the risk. She came back several times, and she later brought her husband, and they did save that relationship, mm-hmm. which was pretty cool.
Well, and ultimately, you helped her change that relationship with those fantasies that she was having.
Yes.
You can have these fantasies.
Yes.
You can still think about these fantasies, but whether or not you make them come to fruition, that's on, you know, that's yes. on your... That those are on your grounds, and so that relationship changed. Like at the beginning of the chapter where you guys talk about you can't not have that relationship.
Right.
I mean, you know, the harder you try to push
yes,
that away,
exactly.
the worse it is, and the harder it
more
is.
More you would cling to it.
So you
right.
held that with her.
Yes.
You
mm-hmm.
held
Here
the fantasies. You opened up your hands and said, let me help you. Mm-hmm.
And it was not by saying, let me help you. It was by the questions
yeah.
that you
yes.
were asking.
The curiosity.
Yeah.
Yes. And feeling understood, mm-hmm. not just heard, but really
fully
understood.
I could get why, given what you're going through, mm-hmm. you'd want to do this. You'd mm-hmm. certainly want to think about doing it.
The risk mm-hmm. for you was to move inside of it. I mean, I'm sure you had to take a deep breath. But if by the end of the session you were convinced that she was driving over there, then you would have had to make a different decision. Right. So you weren't abdicating the responsibility as a therapist in doing it. It's just it's a 180 as far as as far as what we do in a conversation like that. I talk to my students about, here's your civilian response, and now here's your therapeutic response, and they can be different.
Mm-hmm. You can often sit
in judgment as a person. Of course, you're going to say, I would never be that way. I would never have that person as my friend. And as a therapist, that goes over to the side, and you make different choices.
And very often, the choice you need to make is the one that's not logical. Mm-hmm. It would be logical to hold that with aversion. Oh my gosh, I'm going to do this horrible thing. And what you need to do is to be able to walk into it, which is kind of what we do with our clients. We invite them to walk closer to the thing they're afraid of instead of jump on the bandwagon to make it go away. Mm-hmm. So it can be counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. And that's that sort of second order thinking that we do a lot of.
Second order thinking is often thinking like a heretic, thinking outside of the logic that's informing the client's choices. And thinking, is there a way of breaking the rules of that, at least in my imagination, that could help infuse some creativity into the process? I have a couple that I was seeing a while ago, and the wife was continually furious because her husband was failing to initiate sex almost completely. And she was lonely, and she desperately wanted to have a intimate relationship. He had a lot of health concerns, and that was part of it. But at one point I asked, so how does it work in terms of initiation with your relationship? You're waiting for him to initiate. Have you ever initiated? She said, no, that's what he does. That's what his job is. Like, he's the man. And that somehow, and so then it was a process of getting in, why does it make sense for her that it would be somehow wrong? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't count, or it wouldn't be appreciated, or wouldn't be valuable for her if she had to do that. Mm-hmm. I have to do everything else. Why should I have to do that as well? And it was waiting for him to give her the indication that he truly loved her. Mm-hmm. I talked to her recently, and they were having sex, and it was a result of her initiating. So she changed the rules for herself that it made it possible. And then when they did have sex, it was helpful. It did feel good. And she let go of that idea that beginning it was his and only his responsibility.
I want to kind of go back to what you said about your students. I liked the way you said this, that they can have a civilian response. And they can have a therapist response. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to kind of take that and connect it to military personnel and how their relationship to the military often doesn't lend themselves to be able to have maybe responses that go against the military culture, if you will.
Right.
To give you some context as to kind of where my head's at, I was reading a military spouse blog or article or something last night, and one of the things that struck me is that they said military comes first in our relationship. Mm-hmm. We had a podcast earlier on in the year that's called Married to the Military, and so there's this kind of triangulation that happens with being a part of the military, being that military culture, and the relationship you're married to the military, but you may also, you know, have that spouse. And so I'm wondering, even if with military couples, we can add that there's another layer of the relationship, mm-hmm. The five relationships that you all talk about in your chapter, and how that influences their sex life and intimacy and the relationship in general to them, mm-hmm. to themselves. I wonder how therapists can incorporate that
it's almost like another partner in the relationship, mm-hmm. and it's absolutely. Certainly the context mm-hmm. that may define so mm-hmm. much of their relationship. I'm just thinking even in terms of privacy and expectations and appearances and how they have to planning. Present themselves. Yeah, that's planning.
One of the military spouses said, you know, even affection, yes. if they're in their uniform,
PDAs, right?
PDA yeah, is uh-huh. not okay.
Not happening.
And I'm in that to me, it just broke my heart because I'm such an affectionate person. With, you know, children, my loved ones, anyone, and but that's a sign of respect, and that's absolutely. A part of the military culture that I had not thought about until I read that particular military spouse's experience.
But also, then that can't become the enemy, because if you're a military family, then the military is your pride and your right. identity, mm-hmm. and there's so much about, having just attended my father's military mm-hmm. funeral, I know that there's so much about that presence and that formality and that
precision
and the integrity of that, that's so valued. Mm-hmm. So you can't denigrate it. Mm-hmm. And then you have to find a way to include it and integrate it into your relationship that doesn't compromise your ability to be affectionate and to be spontaneous with each other.
What you said at the beginning is it becomes a context. Mm-hmm. And I think that even more than another part of the relationship, that it's the overwhelming or overarching nature of the relationship, the atmosphere for it, like a belief system.
Mm-hmm.
So then what we want to do always as therapists is not challenge a belief system. When I was talking about thinking like a heretic, it was, what are the rules that you're rule-bound, that you don't have to be rule-bound by, that mm-hmm. could change and you would still be you? Mm-hmm. But if there's a rule, thou shalt not have public displays of affection, mm-hmm. then there's no way, you get no place, and you shouldn't try to get anywhere as a
you don't
as
want
a
to challenge that.
Challenging yeah. that. What you can do, though, is broaden the scope of meaning within that belief system. So, for example, military folks and police officers and so on have a very strong and appropriately well-developed idea about strength and about what it means to be in control and so on. And this, I think, contributes to the concern of not appearing weak, and weak equals vulnerable, and vulnerable equals touchy-feely, and so that what gets equated with strength is reserve and withdrawal, mm-hmm. and being tight. Mm-hmm. It is possible to discover the strength of being vulnerable, and that rather than see vulnerability as the opposite of strong, that it's a demonstration of profound strength that can be learned. And so then if you can honor the importance of strength and find different ways of expressing it, it can allow clients to extend the range of what's possible without compromising their sense of who they are.
And that climate, like you said, that they're embedded within.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that they need to be able to thrive in, mm-hmm. not just survive in.
Mm-hmm.
If this is a career military family, then they're mm-hmm. going to need to be able to thrive in that.
Thrive,
context.
Not survive. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a.
You don't want to help them try to get around it, or, you know, mm-hmm. sneak under the radar.
Or push it,
or push
away,
it away.
Or you want, ignore it.
Mm-hmm. How do we embrace our relationship and our intimacy and our vulnerability within this community that we've chosen?
I think there's some small move within the military, and I wish it was so much greater, the recognition that somebody seeking mental health assistance, that is a sign of strength,
mm-hmm.
And that it's fear that keeps people away, and it's fear of consequences, obviously, within the military hierarchy and so on, but also fear of what does this mean for me. It's a very macho kind of, so even with women within the military, it's still this macho sort of ethic of, for me to reach out and talk to somebody for help would mean that I'm weak.
Mm-hmm.
And to recognize and turn around, and that willingness to reach out is a sign of profound courage
mm-hmm.
and strength.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree that that's recognized and promoted within the military establishment would do just wonders for mm-hmm. people being able to take care of themselves in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see shifts
yeah.
However, man, there's a big,
yes, there's a long way to
there's
go.
There's a long way to go. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I could sit here and talk all day with you two.
We could as well.
Prior to us taping, we have definitely. Is there anything else that you'd like to say? Or Barry, is there anything else that you'd like to add? I have tons more questions, but we can follow up later.
We can follow up with a blog, perhaps.
Yes.
Well, I do think it's important for anyone who's considering a career working with families and couples to think about how you would manage talking about sexuality, because we are sexual creatures from birth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to be working with families with small children, mm-hmm. there are sexual issues that come up and need to be discussed, and you have to think about your own comfort level and inviting those conversations with the family. So it's not just how to get adult partners to have better sex, but what messages are we giving children, and mm-hmm. how do we have those conversations in ways that are sex positive, mm-hmm. and that build children's positive relationship mm-hmm. with their own sexuality rather than create shame that then turns into difficult relationships mm-hmm. later in life. So I think it's really important for therapists to see that as a part of their whole mm-hmm. training and toolbox, not as, like Douglas said, something that they would just refer out.
And a part of family wellness.
Yes,
a part
exactly.
of family family strength,
mm-hmm.
you know, is the ability to have those conversations and model that
mm-hmm.
to children.
The other idea that I think is pretty central to what we do is that bodies have a way of communicating a contextual truth or a relationship truth that we can deny consciously. So we might want to have sex with this particular person, or we might want to have this particular kind of sex with this particular person. And when it's not happening, the typical thing to do is to come to a therapist and say, there's something wrong with my body part. And if you approach it the way that we've been talking about, you do think, okay, so if there's this sexual difficulty that's happening, rather than trying to solve it by taking the problem away, how do we understand it as fitting what's happening at the moment? And if we aren't then trying to dismiss it or exercise it in some way, but to understand the integrity of the problem, it makes a tremendous shift in terms of what you want to do to help things being different. So rather than how do we collaborate together in order to cure you of the problem? How do we understand what's going on, that nobody's to blame, and that including your body, and that when you do that, very often problems don't continue. The problems, whatever the reason that they arose in the first place, get maintained through the efforts to try to solve it in an unhelpful way.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what we're doing is by making sense of how this fits, given the situation, we're allowing the problem to resolve without anybody doing anything to cure it.
Mm-hmm. When you change the way you see things,
yes.
the things you see change.
Change, mm-hmm. exactly.
That sticks with me. I learned that in my graduate studies, and it's always rung true.
So an example of that is we don't think about desire disorders.
Mm-hmm.
We think about desire discrepancies.
Mm-hmm.
So this person wants sex more often than this person. This person wants it less.
Mm-hmm.
They each think there's something wrong with the other person because of that. Mm-hmm. But it's a discrepancy. If they had managed to be in a relationship with somebody that had the same needs, desires for frequency, they wouldn't be in our offices. So it is possible to change the amount of time the number of times that you have sex with somebody in a way that doesn't feel like you are compromising your own integrity
mm-hmm.
to do so, but not through the other person guilting you into it or forcing you or being furious at you. And so if there's a discrepancy, there's a way of honoring both members of the couple to shift how that gets decided or how it gets explored with nobody being wrong.
There's a wonderful Woody Allen movie scene
mm-hmm.
where the wife, Diane Keaton, is meeting with her therapist saying, my husband wants to have sex all the time. It's ridiculous. It's crazy. He wants to have sex 3 times a week. And
He must be a sex addict.
And the husband is meeting with his therapist saying, we never have sex. We have sex 3 times a week, maybe, tops. So which one of them is right?
She must be frigid.
Is he an addict? Is she frigid? It's all in how you see it, just what you said. And so we don't have to pathologize either one of them. We have to make sense of their choices and look at the discrepancy.
And which what are their possibilities?
Yes, mm-hmm. Given this, what are their possibilities?
That they're comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And that work for their relationship.
So often they're hoping that if only I can get you, my
spouse,
to do what I want, then everything's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And since you're not doing it, I have to be more intense in the way that I'm trying to get you to do it. And of course, that just exacerbates it horribly. Mm-hmm. So having a different logic for trying to resolve it often changes the problem with ease.
Mm-hmm. Yay. wow. Well, on that note...
You're trying to get us to stop talking, aren't you?
I'm actually thinking, okay, I have about 5 more questions. I wonder how long I can get them to stay. And Martha not bang on the door.
Exactly.
Like you
Where
said,
are
you
they?
Bring
you kidnap them.
You bring them. Well, I did want to say that Douglas and Shelley have a website that you can visit if you're interested in learning about them and their work. You can find it at contextconsultants.com, and I would encourage you to check that out. I know Barry and I have been all over that website in the past.
Yes,
and we've spoke a lot about context today. We thank you so much for
thank you for having
coming,
me.
Yes,
and we
pleasure.
Look forward to
great
hearing
conversation
your talk.
With you.
Yes, great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you'd like to hear more episodes from Anchor, check out the links provided on our website or our episode Learn event. Just enter MFLN Anchored Podcast in your search engine to get you there. We offer continuing education credits for this programming. Information about that can be found on our website, or you can just email our team, MFLN Family Development@gmail.com. We hope you will join us next time.